Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. The story of the world during the Obama presidency is that he has wanted to disentangle us from the ancient hatreds of the Middle East and pivot to our economic future by focusing on Asia with the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal and bringing China into the global economy in a healthy way. But Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Sunnis versus Shiites, dictators versus Islamists, the long blowback from our oil policies and the colonial carve-up of the region into phony countries 100 years ago, it all just won't let us go as the Middle East and Afghanistan keep popping up in places like Paris and San Bernardino. Now, Fred Kaplan of Slate and the Council on Foreign Relations has written a really good and really interesting analysis of President Obama's foreign policy in the context of trying to disengage from this flypaper region in a 7,000-word article in Foreign Affairs magazine, and he joins us now. Hi, Fred. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi. Thanks a lot.
The tension that I just described, you call it the tragedy of Obama's presidency. Why that word?
Well, because it's historical forces, you know, what used to be in ancient history, you know, called the fates or the gods, these truly biblical conflicts that have been plaguing that region for centuries, keep coming back to haunt him. He has tried to take a more limited path in the use of military force. He has tried to pivot or rebalance our concerns from these ancient battles to the Pacific, Asia and the Pacific, which show a lot more promise for growth and trade and prosperity and also a more interesting conflict with China. And yet these, you know, it's sort of like Michael Corleone in Godfather 3. The mafia just keeps pulling him back in. He wants to go legit, but they just keep pulling me back in. And, you know, this isn't unique to Obama's presidency. I think it's going to be something that will plague all presidents for the next several decades at least. These things take a long time to sort themselves out.
This article is really good, and for people who want to get past the ridiculous Republican campaign rhetoric like Chris Christie calling Obama a feckless weakling and really look at the president's philosophy and where it became a tough choice whether to stick to it and where he may have succeeded and failed, this really is an article to read. And it reminds us that Obama laid down the framework of his approach to foreign policy and war in his Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech back in 2009, which includes this one-minute statement of principle.
To say that force may sometimes be necessary is not a call to cynicism. It is a recognition of history, the imperfections of man, and the limits of reason. I raise this point. I begin with this point because in many countries, there is a deep ambivalence about military action today, no matter what the cause. And at times, this is joined by a reflexive suspicion of America, the world's sole military superpower. Yet the world must remember that it was not simply international institutions, not just treaties and declarations, that brought stability to a post-World War II world. Whatever mistakes we have made, the plain fact is this. The United States of America has helped underwrite global security for more than six decades with the blood of our citizens and the strength of our arms.
Fred, why'd you cite that speech and some of the passages in that clip here 6 years later?
Well, you know, I wrote about it at the time in Slate. It struck me as really a startling speech in a number of ways. First, recall, this was a Nobel Peace Prize address, and he spends a good bit of it talking about the justification of force on occasion and the need to stay strong with military armaments. You know, that alone was pretty striking. Second, it went beyond that. It was actually, I remember thinking this at the time and wondering where it came from, because I had been told by several people that he wrote he basically wrote it himself. And it was, I think it was one of the most sophisticated addresses on foreign policy that any American president has delivered. He talked about the need for force, but also the need for alliances, about the distinction between interests and vital interests, and the need to scale the level of force accordingly. And he talked about how, you know, even though we have to stick true to our moral principles, we can't do this mindlessly, that sometimes you have to deal with less savory regimes and perhaps give them something that they're interested in to get them to alter their behavior. And I think as you look through the last 7 years of Obama's foreign policy, with a few notable exceptions, and I try to explain those exceptions in the foreign affairs piece, he has remained remarkably true to the principles that he laid out, or the goals that he laid out in that speech.
Listeners, if you want to call up and ask Fred Kaplan a question or give us your own take in short form about President Obama's foreign policy, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. A good chunk of your article is on the lessons of Libya. And that, of course, was the military operation for regime change against the dictator Gaddafi, in which Obama spoke the phrase "lead from behind."
Right. He actually didn't say that. That was an aide who was quoted anonymously in a New Yorker article. But it's I think not a bad description really of what he had in mind.
So the Republicans have relentlessly mocked him as if his administration had said, "Just fall behind." But lead from behind was an actual strategy for a style of leadership, a third way, as you describe it, when he was originally given two polarized options with respect to Libya. Can you explain what he had in mind with lead from behind?
Right. Well, in the National Security Council meetings over what to do about Libya, and Libya was a strange event because it was on the verge of Gaddafi was on the verge of massacring tens of thousands of his own people. The Arab League had passed a resolution unanimously requesting that the United States intervene. This was unprecedented. The UN Security Council was ready to go with a resolution. NATO allies were urging that we intervene and promised to do several things of their own. I mean, nothing had ever happened like this before. And so what Obama said was, well, look, and this was the thing about interest, the distinction between interest and vital interest. We had an interest in doing something about this, but not a vital interest. So he said, look, there are certain things, certain unique capabilities that the United States can do, you know, precision bombing, coordinating intelligence, logistics, that kind of thing. So we'll do that. But the rest of it, you guys are going to have to do, you know, cleaning up afterwards, helping to create order. This is not our part of the world. This is not our game. France, Italy, you have a much more compelling interest to do something about that. And they said, oh, yeah, we will do this. And they didn't. They didn't for a variety of reasons. The aftermath turned out to be much more violent than had been anticipated. To really control things and to restore order would have required putting troops on the ground, not just peacekeepers, and that was more than the Europeans really wanted to do. And so this template and these consequences, I think, had a major impact on his thinking about Syria, for example. When Assad started bombing his own people in Syria during their uprisings, Obama, the first thing he did was to draw some contrast with Libya. Libya was an open desert. It was very easy to target, your enemies or to bomb your targets. Whereas in Syria, it was intermingled in cities with civilians and friendly forces and unfriendly forces, and you'd be killing a lot of people if you bombed. Second, nobody was inviting us into this conflict, unlike Libya. There were no allies. There was no government that we were in there to support. And so he said, look, I don't really see a way into this that we could really do any good or that really serves our interests. So if you have some ideas, he told his advisors, let me know. And you know, much has been made, and Hillary Clinton makes much of this as well, because she supported it, of this plan that David Petraeus, who was then CIA director, came up with to send arms to a small group of quote-unquote moderate rebels in Syria. And I did quite a lot of investigating into the nature of this proposal. And, you know, everybody now says, oh, if only Obama had accepted the Petraeus plan, none of the stuff going on now would have happened. But I've come to the conclusion that this is just complete nonsense, that this plan was so tepid. And, in fact, in the meetings, Petraeus himself made no promises, no great promises for it. It was basically sending some rifles to a small group of people that had been picked out mainly by Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia, who's always tried to get the United States to come in on to fight the wars that Saudi Arabia doesn't want to fight for itself. And Petraeus had even said, well, this isn't going to lead to Assad's ouster, but it might unsettle him psychologically and would give us skin in the game. And, well, you know, what we know about Obama now is that the last thing that Obama wanted was to have skin in this particular game, a sectarian civil war, and that here was a solution that was being offered up that the proponent of it was admitting wasn't really a solution. So it's that said, I mean, it has been a mess from the get-go, and as I also point out in the piece, Obama is hardly blameless for some of the dimensions of this mess.
I want to go back to Libya for a second, because mm-hmm. you quote the president from his UN speech this year. You tell me, is this an admission that the U.S. made a mistake in Libya, which would be a rare admission of a country making a mistake in a war, or is this blaming the allies in NATO for undermining the mission? Listen.
Even as we helped the Libyan people bring an end to the reign of a tyrant, our coalition could have and should have done more to fill a vacuum left behind.
Why'd you include that quote?
Well, it was the tragedy of Libya, and you notice he says we and our coalition didn't follow through. You know, it's a bit churlish to start singling out your sloughing allies in a General Assembly speech. But you know, he was talking about, yes, first and foremost, the allies who didn't follow through, but also his own decision-making in perhaps not anticipating the difficulties that they would have in doing so. I asked some of his aides if he had known that France and Italy were not going to follow through, would he have made the same decision? Would he have put forces on the ground to follow through himself? Or would he have just not done it? And nobody really knew. They don't know which way that he would come down on that.
And in fact, this relates, and the fact that even Libya, which was supposed to be simple, became more complicated, more violent, which is one of the reasons that the NATO allies didn't follow through with what they maybe thought was going to be an easier cleanup effort after Gaddafi was removed.
Mm-hmm.
Sound familiar, those who wanted the Iraq war, right?
Yeah, it all looks simple from the outset, doesn't it? I mean, we've talked about this, Brian, what a former professor of mine once called the illusion of small-scale maps, or I think it was the fallacy of small-scale maps. You look at a map, a place looks so small and manageable, or especially if it's just a two-dimensional map where, you know, everything is flat and with square corners.
And so my favorite part of your article is when you explain how much Obama thought through the decision not to get more militarily involved in Syria early on, because he was looking many steps ahead, including his desire not to inadvertently set up a proxy war against Iran when Iran would send troops in support of Assad if we were supporting the rebels.
Exactly.
So can you describe the scenario the president was thinking of in a little more detail, and why he ultimately vetoed that plan that you referred to that CIA Director David Petraeus had come up with?
Well, first, as I was saying earlier, it was just an inadequate plan. You know, who are these people that we're sending arms to, and how can we be sure it doesn't go into other people's hands? And but yeah, what you're talking about, the two-step, three-step thing, is and then what happens? Let's say that this force actually does become successful and really does start to put pressure on Assad's regime. Are you suggesting that Iran, which is Syria's main protector in the region, is just going to stand by and let this happen? Or are they going to respond? Are they going to send in forces? And then what do? If then we back down, then we look weaker than we would have if we hadn't done anything in the first place. And it's interesting, he finally did come up with a plan that he found supportable, you know, that they were first doing airstrikes to support Kurdish ground movements, but then also, you know, the CIA-backed rebel force in southern Syria. Well, and look what happened. When that force really did start to get pretty powerful, I mean, one reason that Russia came in was that it looked like Assad was about to fall. But what happened when he did look like he was about to fall? Not only did Iran start sending in Quds forces and special forces, but Russia came in as well. So the caution that Obama expressed and it was concerned about in the initial conversations was completely borne out by what happened in response to the plan that he actually did put into motion.
Fred Kaplan, usually from Slate, has a great long article in Foreign Affairs magazine about 7 years of Obama foreign policy called Obama's Way, the President in Practice. And let's take a phone call. Ben in Lawrenceville has a question. Ben, you're on WNYC.
Hi. Yeah, I actually wondered what your caller, the gentleman thought about the current situation in Libya, which doesn't seem to get quite as much press attention as Syria does. You know, from my understanding, it was kind of in a civil war, and with some ISIS affiliate groups now, you know, just my humble opinion, it's kind of the failure of the Arab Spring to bring about democracy. But I'll take my answer off the air.
Fred?
Yeah, well, Ben, you're absolutely right. You know, quite a long time ago, the person who coined the phrase Arab Spring changed it to Arab Uprising or Arab Revolt. The spring, you know, turned cold very, very quickly. And, you know, one thing that's going on, another point that I make in this article, and I've made it in other forums too, is that, you know, one problem that's going on in the Middle East, it's something that no president can control, and that is basically the collapse of a political order that had been established just after World War I by the French and the British, coming in, redrawing the map, creating these artificial borders, sometimes in ways that would put minority sects overlooking, you know, ruling the majority, and thereby keeping everybody divided and therefore oppressed. This was an order that probably would have collapsed after World War II, along with the British and French colonies, or colonial rule. But the Cold War sort of reimposed an order onto this. And when the Cold War went, imploded, what we see now was at some point sort of inevitable. I'm not being a partisan about this at all, but the invasion of Iraq, which ripped up a kind of rough balance of power between Shiite and Sunni in the region, accelerated this development. So, and then, you know, then you see the crumbling of regimes from Egypt to Libya to elsewhere. Again, there's a human story here that at least initially was very thrilling even. But you're tearing up an order, and there is no political mechanism, no system in place to create it with some other order, and therefore you have anarchy, and that's what we see in that's what we're seeing throughout the Middle East now. And if you look at similar periods of sunder throughout in Europe during the, you know, during certain parts of the last millennium, these things take decades, sometimes centuries, to work out. So, you know, the fact that Barack Obama cannot control the disorder that's going on in Libya or Syria or these other places, where, you know, not only are our interests kind of dubious, but our allies are not consistent. Our allies in this fight against ISIS, for example, also have their own conflicts with one another. And so it's very difficult to put together an effective coalition. So, you know, it before we blame Obama or his successor or his predecessor or anybody for what's going on, it's good to look at some historical structural causes to this.
Was the president naive, though, about the Arab Spring? Because you cite an Obama speech from 2011 when the Arab Spring was in full flower in Egypt, Tunisia, and the early phases in Syria, looking like a people's democracy movement in a region of dictators. And he gave a speech that you describe as uncharacteristically exuberant. Yeah. So here's 53 seconds of that speech.
There are times in the course of history when the actions of ordinary citizens spark movements for change because they speak to a longing for freedom that has been building up for years. In America, think of the defiance of those patriots in Boston who refused to pay taxes to a king, or the dignity of Rosa Parks as she sat courageously in her seat. So it was in Tunisia, as that vendor's act of desperation tapped into the frustration felt throughout the country. Hundreds of protesters took to the streets, then thousands. And in the face of batons and sometimes bullets, they refused to go home, day after day, week after week, until a dictator of more than two decades finally left power.
The president in 2011. Fred, how do you think he looks back on that speech today?
Yeah, you know, at the time it was a very stirring speech. I remember being a little dubious at the time. I called it uncharacteristic exuberance because he's usually much more of a realist and a rationalist, realist in the sense of international relations, you know, realpolitik. I think he got way ahead of himself on this one. It's not insignificant that in the White House at the time, within his inner circle, there were really no experts on Middle Eastern politics. When he started saying things like Assad must go, there was an assumption all around the table at the NSC, I'm told, that he was about to collapse, that Assad really was about to collapse, and therefore we should get on the right side of history. What to do after he collapsed, or what to do if he didn't collapse? I mean, once the president of the United States says things like, you know, Assad must stop bombing his people, Assad must do this, Assad must go, and then if he doesn't go, and if you don't do anything about it, then, you know, you do create some unfortunate perceptions about America's credibility and America's commitment to what it says. And there have been times when Obama has... And again, this I think also is uncharacteristic and rare. Kind of thinks, and this is almost Bushian in a way, that saying something is tantamount to seeing it actually happen. And I think that's where he's gotten into his biggest trouble and his greatest failures.
And if there's a criticism of Obama that you fundamentally accept along these lines, it's the mismatch between his language about Assad and his actions. People usually bring up the red line that he articulated with respect to chemical weapons in this respect. But I'm not sure about the red line, because when it came to that point where Assad had crossed it and used chemical weapons, there was the ratcheting up of pressure to the point where we got Assad to hand over basically all his chemical weapons and be done with them. So why for anyone in the world would that be a worse outcome than bombing?
No, it was a much better outcome, but that was serendipity. That was a rare case of the Russians pulling us out of the fire. The Russians, even when Russia was a great superpower, it was always very much against any of its allies having weapons of mass destruction. Not because they had some unique abhorrence of these weapons, but because they abhorred the loss of control. You know, during the Cold War, there were a couple of NATO, of U.S. allies, Britain especially, that had an independent nuclear force. This would have been just absolutely unacceptable to Russia. So Putin saw Assad with these chemical weapons and acting like completely out of control and like a loose cannon, and possibly egging the United States on to do something which could threaten his regime, which was the only stronghold of Russia outside the former Soviet Union. And so they stepped in and made him dismantle what turned out to be about 95% of his chemical weapons. But again, this was an absolute stroke of luck. It wasn't planned. I think that the big mistake that Obama made in this was to keep, you know, there were, I counted five times in an 8-month period where he used this red line language about if chemical weapons are used, he'll face tremendous consequences, you know, serious damage. And I am told that he never authorized a plan of what to do if this ever took place, and never lined up the pins, either with allies or with people in Congress, of approving something that he was planning. And so when it really did happen, I'm convinced he was ready to bomb, but he also realizes that he needs allies in this. And the allies, which should, again, said, oh, yeah, we'll be with you, and then the British Parliament voted against it. And that's when he said, well, I need to have Congress come in with me. After everybody had said, well, you don't really need Congress for legal authority, and then Congress wasn't going to back him up because the Republicans were not interested in doing him any favor, and a majority of Democrats weren't interested in using military force. This is something about the Republicans, by the way, that I think hasn't been mentioned as often as it should be.
And we have a minute left.
Okay, they blame Obama for being a weakling on this, that, or the other thing. Every time that Obama has gone to them for authorization to be what they see as a strong, mighty force to use military, they dodge it. They still have not passed a resolution authorizing him to use military force against ISIS. They just basically told him, we are not going to vote on this resolution that you want to approve the bombing of Syria. And then they keep hammering him for being, weak. It's just pretty gross hypocrisy in this.
Fred Kaplan has written a long article in Foreign Affairs magazine that takes a very deep and very interesting dive into President Obama's foreign policy, particularly with respect to the Middle East, gets way below the surface of a lot of the silly rhetoric that's out there. It's called Obama's Way, the President in Practice. Thanks a lot, Fred.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, the 2015 Data Awards, Earnest and Snarky. Stay with us.